anything in it?
Maybe.
No.
Good evening, folks. My name is Manny, and I'm an alcoholic. Oh, these chairs don't go in, so I'll come in. This is the biggest hammer I've ever seen. Look at this, a construction tool. Oh, boy. Keep everybody in their place.
Sean got that for me.
Sean got that for you? Wow. Sean, this is like, you know, we could build this church with this. The foundations. I can't see what that says.
John
Barleycorn. Okay. Thank you, Sean. This is, it's an honor to be here. That's for sure. This is probably one of the churches that got me sober in my early recovery. My sobriety date's July 3rd, 1993. But I was around in since 1992. I'm going on 12 and a half years. I'll be 13 one day at a time next July, God willing. And I used to come to this this hall every single Tuesday night, religiously. I used to come to Sunday nighters at City Councilors religiously too on Sunday nights. You know, and I missed that place, actually. Anyway, I'm going to identify, and I don't really want to go into a drunkalogue. My story is long and long, and it drags on. The drunkalogue, I'll tell you that right now. But I'll tell you what started it. And I'll give you a few ideas. I'll identify for you. I'm just like every other alcoholic. I believe I did not fit in. I was born not fitting in. I'm the middle child of, I have an older brother and a younger sister, and they seemed to get all the attention, and I got none. I got the hand-me-downs from my brother, and my sister got everything new, my brother got everything new. And I was told, coming back from an ethnic background that I came from, you see, the eldest was supposed to go to school, university, and take care of us, and we were supposed to go to work, and I was supposed to go to work, and if I needed any help, the eldest doctor or lawyer would take care of me or whatever. And I was put out into the restaurant business quite early in my school career, and actually because of that I ended up quitting school and just walking out and starting on my merry way. I was a very good student. Much better than my older brother, who finally dropped out. By force, he ended up in Concordia, and he didn't want to be there. So he finally dropped out and decided to join me in the restaurant business, and my family's been in that business forever, as far as I can remember. But it wasn't a business for me. I was more into school. I would have liked to continue my school. I asked to do that, and they told me they wouldn't. They weren't interested in financing it or helping me or anything. And as a kid, I decided, you know, screw that, you know, they're not interested in helping me, that must mean I shouldn't go. So I got into a lot of trouble, and then I started, we also had alcohol in our family since we were kids. They would have parties, the adults, on Saturday night. I remember being brought up here in the plateau. Saturday nights, the big parties, they would come into the house. They would move. We lived like four families together in these huge eight and a half room houses. They'd move the coffee table out of the living room and start dancing around in circles all night long drunk. And they'd put a little table for the little kids in the next room, a small table, me and my cousins, a deck of cards, and with a little thimble glass of booze in it for everybody. And so we would play cards and drink these little thimble glasses. And they gave us all their change, so we don't bother them, so they could dance around in circles all night long. And yippee and hooray and all that stuff. Needless to say, I was exposed to alcohol and alcoholism very young. It was in my family all along. Personally, I think that it's a family disorder. I think it comes down through the ages. I think it's genetic, personally. But nevertheless, that's my opinion. And what happens is that during our little card games, I remember this now. It didn't occur to me when I came in here in 92. I remember it now, that during the card games, a lot of my cousins would drink that stuff and go, burn and this and that. But by the end of the little pennies game, I had drank all their glasses and was looking for more. And I was no more than six. Couldn't have been six. I remember drinking their glasses and falling asleep on the coats on top of the bed where everybody had thrown their coat. I was asleep on that. They'd wake me up to take me up to a couch or to a bed or wherever they would put me. Anyways, I remember also saying to myself, the day will come when I'm going to do this right. And I was six. So I don't know if I was an alcoholic then or not, but I knew one day I was going to do it right. That's all I knew. And the day finally did come during high school when I decided to pull out of school, when my folks said, you know, you've had enough schooling. You've got grade 9. You're in grade 9. That's enough schooling. Get to work right now, you know. And I was a straight-A student. And my parents decided it's okay. He doesn't want to go to school. It's cool. My principal didn't like that. At the school, called my dad. They became very close friends. They argued and discussed and, I guess, debated this thing over and over again for years. But I had quit school. And immediately there in grade 9, you got to understand, being neglected the way I was, I had a mother who was not that straight with me. A lot of people have difficulties with their dad. I had difficulties with my mom. My mom was not a straight shooter with me. With my brother, yes. We're three in the family. Each one of us, you have to take us into a separate room and ask us questions on how we grew up. You're going to find three massively different stories. Mine was horrible. I'll tell you that right now. This lady called me stupid and no good from the day I was born. And that's the way it was. And that's what I believed. I don't care if I was getting a 98 in math or physics or whatever. I was stupid and no good. And then I proceeded to show her how stupid and no good I was. In the age of grade 9, at grade 9, I guess, I don't know, 14, 13, around there, I hit a crossroads and I met up with a tough gang. I was a friend of the nerdy guys and a friend of the tough guys because I didn't want to get beaten up. So I joined the tough guys and off we went into the drug world and alcohol world. I've done every single drug. I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous. I've done every single drug you can possibly imagine, but alcohol is my drug of choice. There's no doubt about it. I would not touch a drug or gamble or do anything unless there was alcohol in front of me. And I mean, you could throw lines down. I'll look at them. If I don't see the case of 2-4, I don't touch it. And that includes gambling, the whole ordeal, all the way down the line, sex, right into the little jail cell sitting sleeping on the cement floor, which I've done many times. So, like I said, grade 9 it all started. I got involved in violence with the gangs and this and that and got a little bit crazy. And I'm really not going to go into it, but there was a lot of violence. And the police were at my house almost every single week. They had begun to know me by name. First name, calling my parents, discussing with my parents what your juvenile son has been doing, the delinquent. They ended up putting me in juvenile delinquent penitentiaries or prisons or whatever you want, holding centers, St. Valier, Berthelet, I did them all as a juvenile. But I knew I didn't like jail. I was clever enough to know that. Jail and I were not going to be friends because I couldn't be free. I couldn't do the craziness, the stuff I wanted to do. So the day I hit 18, crime stopped. Crime stopped immediately. Cold turkey. Crime. Not insanity. Crime. Let's get this clear. The insanity raged on forever. But the crime had stopped. There was no more jail for this guy. However, I spent, I would say in my life, probably close to a year and a half in the drunk tank in Bonesicker. And I was stupid enough to get caught every Friday. So I had to wait till Monday for court. I never did it on Monday. I did it on Friday. Every single week, like an idiot. That's why I say it was clockwork guaranteed a year. In my using for 20 years, I spent at least a year in there. In Bonsecur, plus they shipped me off once to Parthenay and once to Bordeaux, but that was for a weekend or something. Anyway, minor stuff. I didn't do the crime stop. What happened, I replaced it as a workaholic. I started to work 15, 12-hour days to support my habit. I would not go and rob a bank. I would not rob a dépanneur, but I would work 12 hours a day. Luckily, I had a good work ethic, and that was the way I survived. I worked and used. Worked and used. My reward at the end of the week was to use. I never received a paycheck from the day I started working until the day I got sober. I had always borrowed in advance. I was always behind. It never stopped, and it continued for 20 years. 17 years, I don't know how long I used, to be honest with you. But I used so many things that I baked my brains, to be honest with you. I remember drinking Aqua Velva. I drank Aqua Velva in St. Valier. I still feel it sometimes in my dreams. Aqua Velva, man. Had there been dollar stores back then, my choice alcohol would be alcohol from the dollar store, mixed with orange juice. That's what I would be drinking. I drank right to the bottom of the barrel. I had to get out of this head. I could not live in this head for 1 minute. Not 1 minute of the day. Even today, I've said it. At gunpoint, I wouldn't go back to adolescence. At gunpoint. I'm happy with where I'm at today. If you had to take me back to adolescence, the way I was back then, I was so complex and I didn't understand what the hell was going on around me. The whole world was gray. That the scariest thing in the entire world was to walk up to you on the street corner and say hello. I couldn't do it. It was terrifying. What would happen? How would you react? What if you said hello back? What would I say? My eyes were always down. I was low self-esteem, no self-esteem. And that came from the treatment I had as a child from my mother. And the terrifying fear she instilled in me, crippling fear which follows me even today. But today at least I don't run away from it like I used to, and I know where it comes from. And the reason I keep coming back to it is because I need you to understand that if I didn't know where my problem started, I would never have known how to fix it. And for me, that's extremely important. I found out where the problem stemmed from, and I worked my way out of it, understanding, fully forgiving and accepting of what the heck had happened. I don't care what they did. It was my fault. Yes, I accept all responsibility for everything I've done. But at least I know there were some people who were participants. They may not have been participants after I hit the age of 16 to 18, but they were participants from 16 down. But it was my responsibility to put the brakes on it, and I could not. There were several kids paying their own way going through school, just like everybody else does today. I see it, a million people could do it. I could have done the same. I chose to go into drugs and alcohol. Nevertheless, I'm not going to work on a lecture. I do that for a living. I'm sorry to say. I'm not that nervous up here. It doesn't really scare me that much anymore. I used to be. In 1992, I came inside this room. A girl walked up to me and told me, "You're reading the 12 steps. You're reading the 12 steps. Art, would you like to? You're reading the 12 steps. I slowly, when they lowered the lights, there was candles on the table. I snuck out, and I went out and drank. I went out and drank, and used again. It terrified me. It took me a year and a half to come back here to this meeting. It took me a year to get back into AA, but a year and a half to come back here, because I was terrified to stand up in front of you and speak. I don't care if it was to speak, read, whatever. Only with a Halloween mask on could I have done it. There's no other way I would have been able to get up there. I was so ashamed of myself and so much fear instilled in this guy. It was incredible. So what my parents did, because I was such a mess, and it's pretty hot in here, eh? Not that bad. Another level was. Because of the mess that I was, I had become, my parents couldn't handle that since the police were coming to my house on a weekly basis. So what we do, from the old country, when I say the old country, I talk about Europe, Southern Mediterranean. What we do from the old country is we send the problem child to relatives. So they packed me up and I started on a journey of 20 years in the United States, from state to state, state to state, state to state. Everywhere I went, I brought myself with me. I got thrown out of a couple of states. I got escorted out of a few, almost at gunpoint. I almost got killed in a few. But I had a black belt in geographical cures. You could be sure of that. Every single state I went to, I knew I was leaving. I never went to one to stay. And then one day on my way back, I stopped. I said, "That's it. I can't do this any longer." And I was a young kid. I was 14, 15. On my way back, I stopped off in New York, March 16, 1982. I stopped off in New York. It was the day before St. Patty's Day parade. And my family has in the food industry in New York City too. So my cousin had a place like this where they had these hot dog and pretzel carts. And he brought me to the basement. He took a picture of me, plastified it, stuck it on me, and I was an American citizen and licensed to boot. Within 15 minutes, my cousin could make you a naturalized citizen. I was never a citizen in the United States. For 20 years I spent there, I was never a citizen, never legally there. But in New York, I was a citizen, and I was naturalized with papers and social insurance, and everything, in like 5 minutes. My cousin was an expert, and it was really good. We had a great operation going, and I proceeded to work in New York City for 10 years. 10 years was... I love New York. I still love New York. New York is a fantastic city, but it takes experience to live there. It's not a city you walk into and automatically just go with the flow, like you would in Montreal. You'd walk down St. Catherine or something. Over there in New York, as soon as you're going with the flow, there's somebody watching you. You better look. It takes a while for your eyes to get the chicken legs, so people realize you're a New Yorker. Until that time comes, it depends on all individuals, anywhere from 6 months to 2 years, I would imagine, you're going to get robbed on a constant basis without realizing it. They will take your stuff, and then after a while, you're going to be smiling, and hey, wait a minute, and they're lost in the crowd, and no reports, police can't help you, the police don't even bother. So I love New York, needless to say. I found a city I could drink in 24 hours a day. I could find any drug I wanted downstairs at the convenience store, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I was in heaven, and I had a job, my own business, with my cousin and my godfather, and we were making dump truck loads of money. It just kept coming in for 8 years. It just kept coming in. I remember walking down Broadway, Times Square. These commando pants that I was wearing, when I came into recovery, I was still wearing. I don't remember how long I wore them. I don't even know where I got them. I just remember them removing them off me with tongs at the Montreal General Psychiatric Ward. And I think they wanted to burn them. I'm not sure. But they had thousands of dollars in them, and the next morning I was begging my cousin for a dollar so I could buy a sandwich with eggs and potatoes and a coffee at the deli next door to our huge garage there. And that persisted for 10 years. And I always told those people, I'm going back to school, so I couldn't give a shit about saving all this money. What do I need all this money for? I'm going to take this money and have fun with it. And it worked out differently. I never saved a dime. And I remember leaving New York City after my godfather had gotten fed up. He came back to Montreal. And God rest his soul, he passed away over here. His bones got cancerous he retired and passed away. And he was my best friend in the whole world. He's the person who raised me. He was my mother, my father, everything. When I went to New York, I was so naive, so stupid. I don't even want to use the word stupid. It just doesn't, it's not appropriate. It's just naive. I thought I knew everything. I haven't been Florida, Texas, Arizona, Chicago. I mean, I've been so many places. I knew nothing. This man raised me, you know, to be a man, I guess. To be an adult to some extent. He was my best friend. And he passed away when he moved here from New York. And that was the time that the business started to sour. So I decided to come back to... It was in 1992. 91, 92, in between there. I can go into a million stories. Horror stories, funny stories for you that happened in New York City. New York City is not a place to be looking for trouble. You better be careful if you're looking for trouble. You better be careful if you're crazy, because there's someone crazier than you. New York City is a great place to drink and isolate while you drink in your own little place if you're going to do it the way I did. Because I was rolling down the 4th Street in the Village one day, right in the middle of the street, and I came out of a blackout. And I looked in the four corners, there was a nightclub. I don't know which one bounced me and what I did, but I wasn't going to any of those four nightclubs that night. And I knew my life was in danger over there. Plus, my best friend who lived upstairs from me, Johnny, who used to deal cocaine, and I used to drink and use his cocaine, got blown away by a professional for $20. I mean, life is not worth to say. It's not Montreal. The world, this is the greatest city in the world as far as I'm concerned. Let me tell you that, because I saw it. They brought him down the stairs, they unzipped the body bag, and I identified the body, and there was a hole that big in his chest. Nobody heard a thing, nobody saw a thing, and it was noon, broad daylight. So, that's one of the situations that I had gone through there, but there was a lot of funny situations too, and a lot of fun I had there too, I have to admit. Today, in retrospect, when I look back, I don't remember ever having fun or being happy while using. The first time I experienced happiness was about 3 or 4 years into AA, not when I just came in. When I just came in, I had the uncomfortable feeling they talk about. I couldn't join a group, like Sean says. I would have joined the group and then become comfortable. And then I fought it forever. I was eternally anxious all the time, realizing that I'm hyperactive. I'm not an anxious individual. I'm a hyperactive guy, and that's what it is. It's ADHD. It's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It's a learning disability. I have complicated difficulties learning. That's all it was. Back then, in the 70s, they would medicate this disease with Valium. They give you Valium to calm you down. It's the opposite thing to do. Today, they medicate it with a stimulant, Ritalin, which is like an amphetamine. Because the ADHD, anyway, let's not go into it. That's not what we're going into. The thing is that I came back to Montreal, and again, once again, the same thing started over again. I started the geographical cures. I came to Montreal, I started working in the restaurants for friends of mine I had grown up with. They were successful, they had gotten married, they had had children, they were doing very well, all of them. And I found myself coming back to Montreal after making $500,000 cash in Manhattan and blowing it all on crack and alcohol and whatever. I came back with a half a pack of cigarettes from Manhattan. That's it. That was my life savings. And a Mickey Mouse watch I had found in a washroom there. And I had, I don't know, 10 years I had that watch. They're good watches, man. They really are. So I came back here and I went home. Needless to say, my folks didn't want me near the house. And they said, we don't want you here. We don't know where you're going to go and what you're going to do, but you're not welcome here. I never was welcome in that house, and that was one of my biggest problems all my life. I was not like the rest of the kids. I always used to be envious of my friends who would go home and their mother would give them a hug or something, say, welcome, my kid, this and that, take care of them, feed them. I was never welcome. I'd walk in, treated like shit from the minute I walked in there. But it never happened in front of my father. My father and I are close. It always happened behind his back, but he was never around. So he doesn't know this, what I'm actually saying right now. He has no idea, no clue. I've tried to explain it to him. He lives today. He's young and he's still pretty good. Still pretty good shape, knock on wood. He doesn't believe it. He says, that's impossible. He says, if you say that about your mother to other people, he says, they're going to spit on you. I said, yeah. You'd be surprised. Nevertheless, I came back to Montreal. I wasn't welcome at home. I never was. So I moved to St. Jerome, a little town after New York City. I moved up to the mountains. St. Jerome from Manhattan is a huge difference. It's almost a trauma. You know, you haven't seen the skies for 10 years. You're gray as a ghost. You look like a Halloween creature. All right? And then you're out there and all you see is sky. It's incredible. What is this little village? It was almost traumatic. But I had a very, very good deal. It was an offer I couldn't refuse by one of the friends of mine that I went to elementary school with, Milk and Cookie Brats. We ended up going to St. Jerome. And I stayed there for a year. And on the 15, on your way up to St. Sauveur or St. Jerome, there's a little motel just before you hit St. Jerome called Best Western. There's a little dive in the Best Western. It's about four of these, like a cubicle. I got thrown out of it. They threw me out. I got bounced out of that place. In the Best Western. It was the only dive in the entire little city. It was it, and I got bounced out. And the trouble continued. After a year in St. Jerome, it didn't work out with my buddy, who thought he had gone really high, and I was extremely low, and he was right. And he decided to make light of it, and this and that, so it didn't work out. You know, he didn't keep his word, and I wasn't going to stand for that. I had too much pride and ego, so we decided to part separate ways, and I went to this smaller town called Lachute, which is no bigger than three times the size of this church. Lachute. I said, there's not much trouble I can do here in Lachute. I was working in a pizzeria. I said, how busy could this place be? And I was living upstairs in a hotel. The guy downstairs was paying for it. And he was paying me a lot of money. Everywhere I went, I had the golden touch. Only when I came into AA, I stopped having money. When I was out there, I had money. Now I don't know how I could use, even if I wanted to. I'm broke. Nevertheless, things are getting better. After 12 years. Anyway, I was making a fortune, and then the guy flipped me off the papers, put me on unemployment. He was a wheeler dealer himself. And I stayed in this little town, Lachute. It didn't take 2 weeks for the staff. I managed his store. There was a 32-person staff in there. I was pretty good at what I do. Most alcoholics are pretty good at what they do. We need the money. We need the money. I never got a paycheck. I was always into the hole, but I borrowed 50 bucks on Friday every week. You know, and I managed the place very well. It didn't take 2 weeks for the staff to go out and buy me a beautiful mug, because they each had their own individual mug. Mine said Maniac on it. 2 weeks. They knew me right away. They said, this guy's not well. He's the guy brought a maniac in from out of town. They were scared, and I don't blame them. And I was near, I was close to the bottom of the barrel at the time. I was like about 120 pounds. But I was dangerous. I walked around with a huge stick in the pizzeria. I had a stick. I remember the waitresses crying, the dishwashers. I'm doing negotiations in the middle of lunch, supper time. There's six phones ringing off the hook. It was a madhouse, and I fit in just perfectly. Just perfectly. It's just like you just added another nut right to there. Like there was a track for me to follow. It was incredible. Like an electric train. I fit in perfectly. It didn't even shake the place. The guy was so happy to have me there. It was incredible. And this is the man who introduced me to the big book. He told me, man, because every time he'd leave, I'd empty his beer cooler. So he put a lock on it. He thinks I'm stupid. I said, the guy put a lock on the beer cooler. What an idiot. So I tell one of the pizza drivers, you got a delivery over there on your way back. Bring back a case of 24. This guy told me, Manny, I know what your problem is. He says, you're the best worker I've ever had. He says, over here, I've been here 30 years, you're the best I've ever had. He says, but you, my friend, are an alcoholic. I said, I'm an alcoholic? I said, you walk in here in the morning, you take a little glass like this, you fill it up this much with scotch, and it doesn't go down all day long. And you have a brand new Volvo outside. The two headlights are broken and the two brake lights are broken. I said, who's the alcoholic? The guy says, Manny, you're an alcoholic. Trust me. Listen to me. He says, take this book and read it. Me, I took the book. I propped up the slice machine and I was cutting easier the smoked meats. I said, this is a good book. I said, thank you. Thank you for that book. And I'm slicing smoked meat sandwiches with this book. I never imagined what he had given me. He doesn't know what he gave me to this day. He's still there. But him and I didn't see eye to eye by the end of that year, needless to say. And I could have killed him. When I came into recovery in 1992 and walked through that door, 1993 I found a sponsor, because I slipped around back and forth my first year. In 93, when I found that sponsor, I told him my main objective is I'll get sober after I kill somebody. I've got this guy I've got to kill. I had the plan, and I was desperately guaranteed I had devised this. I was going to rent a car, run him down on Main Street, come back, give back the car, let the insurance cover it, but I'd have killed that bastard. That was my main objective in life. My sponsor says, you're completely crazy. You're not going to do anything of a sort. You're going to pray for him. I said, you are stupid. I'm going to pray for that guy. Forget it. I'm going to kill the bastard, and then I'm going to get sober. And that was my main objective in life. That's why I was going to get sober. It was because I wanted to kill that guy. That's how much I hated him with such a passion. I was such an angry individual. I had been raised as a fearful cripple. I was crippled by fear. I walked around in Manhattan with a gun underneath my belt. And eventually I was ready to kill someone. I had committed. This guy will die. That's how insane my brain had become. Baked Alaska, or whatever you want to call it. It took me a long while. And meanwhile, while that guy, that hate, that anger, that resentment that festered in my mind and grew like a cancer, that guy, 2 or 3 years later, called me up and asked me to his house for a party. I couldn't sleep wanting to kill him. He thought we were friends. I told him, "Are you fucking nuts?" I said. He said, "Yeah, and I'm opening up a new store. I want you to run it. I want $10,000 a week, you fucking asshole," I told him. He said, "What? What's wrong with you, Manny? Are you crazy?" I said, "Go fuck yourself." He didn't understand what I was talking about. The guy said, "Man, this guy's out of his mind. What's the matter with you, man? Are you okay? Where are you? In the crazy house?" That's what he was asking me. "Are you okay, Manny?" He was genuinely worried as why I was so nuts. For 3-4 years, I planned to kill this guy. And the guy didn't even know there was a problem between us. That's how nuts I was when I came into these rooms. That's all you need to know. That's what alcoholism will do to you. I was a blackout drinker from day one. And I mean, my story consists of taking a drink at 15 and waking up at 32. That's it. That's the whole story. I don't remember a damn thing that happened between 15 and 32. Nothing. My life began at 32. It's like I was born. I ended up in the Montreal General after that. There was always a divine inspiration. I believe in God and I love St. Francis' prayer. There was somebody out there watching over me all along because I was not well. And he guided me through, and I don't know why he brought me here. I don't know why I was chosen. But it's an absolute total miracle, and I'm eternally grateful to all of you and God. Because if it wasn't for God, I don't think I would have stayed, my higher power. It made it an individual program for me. I could work it my way. I could not get sober your way, as I'm sure none of you can get sober my way. I followed this book, and I passed it through the crazy gears of Manny, and it worked for me. I ended up in the psychiatric ward at the Montreal General Hospital. They sent me to a treatment center. I spent 6 weeks there. It was an absolute waste of time, too much thumb twiddling time. It was a bunch of baloney. I left there. I went to the place that sent me there. And I stayed with them for 7 years. I did therapy. I saw psychologists, psychiatrists. They medicated me. They diagnosed me with bipolar disorder. They stopped the bipolar disorder because they said, "You're not bipolar, Manny." I said, "Well, congratulations. Why do you have me on these stupid pills?" So they stopped me with the bipolar medication. They tried Ritalin. I couldn't handle it because coffee and Ritalin don't mix. Your skeleton wants to jump out of your skin and go running down the street. It's bad enough. I'm hyper. So they said, "Cut the Ritalin, Manny." All right. And I ended up, they realized I was a reasonably intelligent guy. They told me, "Who told you you're stupid?" I said, "I was always stupid. I know I'm stupid." "No, you're not." Anyway, they asked to see the person who told me. My mom would not go and visit the hospital. Neither would my dad. And they asked me if I should maybe change vocations. I was in the restaurant business. My life was destined to flipping bergens and cutting souvlakis or whatever. That was my life. And they asked me to go back to school and do some volunteer work. And I said, "Wait a minute, man. I don't work for free. It's either they pay me or I don't work." And I ended up taking old folks to hospitals on the West Island for nothing. And out of that, I ended up back in high school. I finished my high school. This in recovery. And then I started on this quest in university. And I didn't go to university for the right reasons, just like I didn't enter AA for the right reasons. I came to AA to silence the parents and buy some time in the house. I went to university because these beautiful, the most beautiful blue eyes you've ever seen in your life and blonde hair asked me to. I said, "Yeah, I would have gone to China if she said so." But she chose university, so I followed her there. She quit the following year, but I was committed and stuck in there. And it was a Montreal General who wrote the application because I didn't have the capacities. My brain did not function properly. That's why they asked me to go to high school, and get check and see if you can pass a grade or something before you enter university, because we don't know if you're capable of learning. So finally, I went with her down to Concordia University. I stayed there. I got a bachelor's degree. I worked in the Center for Behavioral Neurobiology for 2 years. I did research on addictions with rats. I injected them with drugs and all kinds of stuff. It's very important to understand anonymity. I do. I understand anonymity well. Had one of my professors known I was a drug addict or an alcoholic, every single day there was drugs missing from our laboratory, they would have blamed it on the alky. So I keep my anonymity out there as much as possible. That's why I'm hoping this stays anonymous. And Sean mentioned, he highlighted anonymity in his preamble. So I graduated with my bachelor's degree, and then I moved on and I went over to McGill and I did a master's degree in psychology. Then I continued on and I finished 1 year of the doctorate, and I burned out. I'm going back next September. I'm going to continue school for life. I love school. That's where I should have been in the first place. I shouldn't have been involved in gangs and the rest of the stuff that I was involved in. Every single day when I went to class, I would make a class. My schedule looked like class in the morning, meeting in the afternoon, St. James the Apostle, because I was the downtown campus, and class at night at Loyola or something. And that's how I went through school. For 10 years, people in AA saw me walking around with a knapsack. Every single day. There's several people who know that. I continued my school. It took me 11 years to finish because I did a lot of work in there. I'm a published author. I'm a psychologist. I work with addicts and I work in the neurotic disorders privately. I work in an addiction center. I'm the clinical director. And I'll be honest with you, all means nothing. The only thing I ever sought when I came into recovery, after 2 years of recovery, I asked my sponsor, I said, I just can't get this. I'm so unhappy. I want to die. I had never been suicidal in my entire life until I was sober for 2 years. When I got my 2-year medallion, I wanted to die. And then he told me the only thing is because you're chasing too many material things and you're looking at the external world and playing the victim. He says the only thing you should be chasing is the big H in front of you. Like the bat signal with Batman, just put a big H there, chase happiness. Chase happiness and everything will come. And today, I can honestly tell all of you right here, I'm honestly speaking to you, because what you see is what you get. This is the real Manny. I am probably the happiest guy I know, and I wish the same thing to each and every one of you. Thank you very much. Thank you.